And we stop, and the car is surrounded, and he says, where is Maharaji? It means great king. And they say he's up on the hill, and he goes running off up the hill, and everybody's sort of ignoring me. And I'm following him, stumbling behind this 6'7" giant, you know, and he's crying and running, and I'm stumbling, and I'm angry and bugged, and I don't want to do this. And we walk around a hill so that we're out of sight of the road, and we come into a hillside with a valley behind it, a beautiful scene, and there is sitting a little old man with a blanket, and he's surrounded by about 8 or 9 Indians. And this tall fellow is stretched out flat in what's called Dunda Pranam, with his hands touching the feet of this man, and he's crying, and the man's patting his head and smiling. And I take a look at this scene, and it's quite beautiful, but I'm too bugged to really appreciate it. And I think, well, I'm not going to touch his feet. I mean, you know, we don't do that in the West. So I sort of stood back, figuring, look, I can just be an observer. I'm just a passenger in the car. I don't have to do anything. After a little while, this old man pulled his hair, and he said to him, have you got a picture of me? And the boy said, yeah. And he said, well, give it to him. So I thought, gee, that's very nice, you know. This little old man's going to give me a picture of himself. And I smiled, thank you very much, you know. But see, there was a guy who would translate. The school principal was one of the 8 people, and he would sort of say everything in English after it was said. Then he looked up at me, and I was still, like, very uptight. He looked up at me, and he said, you came in a big car? Like the one topic, see, that I'm uptight about. So I said, yeah. He said, you'll give it to me? So I started to say, well... And this young fellow said, Maharaji, if you want it, it's yours. And I said, now, wait a minute. You can't go giving away David's car. It's not our car to give away. This little old man says to me, you made much money in America? So I said, yeah, one time I made. He said, how much did you make? So I was like into bragging. I needed something for my ego. I said, well, one year I made $25,000. So they all figured that out in rupees, and everybody was impressed. So it's like 60 billion rupees or something like that. So he said, you'll buy a car like that for me? Now, I grew up in a family that was very involved with Jewish charities, and I knew about getting money, but I had never been hustled so fast in my life. I didn't even know who he was, and he was already asking me for a $7,000 car. And he's smiling at me all the time. He's putting me on. That's really what it boils down to. So I say, well, perhaps. And then he says, take them away, give them food. And we're taken off and given food. Big sumptuous feast. At the end of the feast, we rest, and then we're brought back to him. And he says, come sit. So I go and sit down. He said, you were out under the stars last night. You were thinking about your mother. Yeah. She died last year. Close his eyes for a second. And he said, she got very big in the stomach before she died. I said, yeah. He says, spleen. She died of spleen. When he said that, 2 things happened to me. One was that my mind raced faster and faster and faster through every conceivable CIA super paranoia I could conceive of to figure out what was happening to me. I mean, who was putting me on? Like, had they brought me here? Was this some monstrous training program? A dossier was spread behind this little man. He pushed a button and the ground opened up. And I mean, like, that's very far out, because even the guy I was traveling with didn't know that stuff. And I was just a passenger in the car. You know, boy, they're really good at their game. And I went through, like, what are the probabilities, you see? Because, see, in the past, I was in this position that when things like this happened, they didn't happen to me usually, they happened to somebody else, and I said, well, that's nice. We certainly have to keep an open mind about those things. And and when it did happen to me, I was always out of my head on psychedelics, and how did I know it had happened and I hadn't just created the whole thing out of whole cloth? Because I had taken some psychedelics that did that kind of thing. I had taken, I remember taking a thing called JB318. And I was sitting in a room and nothing was happening, and I thought, gee, nothing happens with this drug, does it? Even though the fellow I took it with, who was about 50, was doing cartwheels through the room. But I felt nothing. And then this girl from the community I was living in walked in and she said, would you like some lemonade? And I said, that would be great. And she poured this glass of lemonade and it got to the top and she kept pouring and it went over the side and down the side and across the wall and up the wall and across the ceiling and down and under my pants. And then it went back up and my pants got wet and I moved, and then it went back up, and as it touched the glass disappeared and the girl disappeared and my wet pants were no longer wet. And I turned to Ralph Metzner, who was sitting next to me, and I said, Ralph, you know, the most unusual thing just happened to me. And Ralph disappeared. And thus, I was perfectly willing when the people at Harvard said, you people have been taking these drugs, you are therefore not reputable scientists anymore as observers. And I was perfectly delighted to say, I will be data. You know, study me, and it may be, it's too bad what happened to those guys in the 60s at Harvard, you know. So my mind went faster and faster and faster, and then it went through every desperate ploy and search through all the storage units. And then, just like a computer that has been fed an insoluble problem, finally, so the machine doesn't burn out entirely, a red light goes on and a bell rings and the machine stops. And that is what happened. My mind just gave up. And simultaneously, and this was not, I couldn't experience it as cause and effect. All I experienced it was the simultaneity of it. He was looking right at me and sort of just looking right at me. I felt this very violent tugging sensation in my chest. It was very painful. And I started to cry. And I cried, and I cried, and I cried. And I wasn't happy, and I wasn't sad. The closest I could come to description of feelings was like, I'm home, or it's over, or phew, or it's all right, or wow, you know, that kind of feeling. Cried and cried and cried, and they took me away. And I was taken to a temple about 12 miles away, and I was given a nice room, and I was sitting in the room, and during the evening I was very confused, and at one point I was going through my shoulder bag and I came to the bottle of LSD. I thought, this guy is going to know what LSD is, because he knows everything. I'll have to ask him. Next morning at 8 o'clock, messenger comes, Maharaji wants to see you. We go over the 12 miles to the temple. I'm just approaching him about 5-6 yards away from him, and he yells out, have you got a question? And I take one look at him, and all I want to do is touch his feet. I don't have any question. It's so warm and beautiful, and there's so much light coming out of him. And I say, no, I don't have any question. And he says, he gets very impatient, and he says, where's the medicine? Medicine? So Guru Brother says, well, maybe he means the LSD. I said, LSD? Acha, the LSD. Bring the LSD. So I go and I bring the bottle of LSD. I hold out my hand. He wants to see. So I hold out my hand and pour it in. He says, well, what's that? I said, well, that's LSD. And so that's STP and that's Librium, that's two and all, and, you know, it's my traveling kit. In those days, I hasten to add, for the benefit of the people whose business it is to protect us from those kind of traveling kits. And he says, does it give you siddhis? And I didn't know what the word siddhis meant. And I said, siddhis, and it was translated as powers to me. And I didn't realize it was spiritual powers. I thought he was asking for physical power. I thought he wanted something like vitamin B12. And I didn't have anything like that. And I was really depressed, because I really wanted to give him whatever he wanted. I mean, I would have given him anything at that point. He could have the Land Rover if he wanted. So I said, gee, I'm sorry, I don't have that. And I poured it back into the bottle, and I was very sad. Oh, no, no, and he holds out his hand. So I put one pill in his hand, and these are called white lightning, and they were about 275 micrograms of LSD, but these were a special batch that had been made for me as a going-away present, and they were each 305 micrograms. He looked, and he, come on, come on. So I put a second on his hand, that was 610 micrograms. For a 70-year-old man, you usually, you know, like 150 under suitable conditions. And can't be too careful with it. You never know about the heart. And he looks and he says, come on, come on. So I put a third one, that's 915. That's going to do it. I mean, it's good LSD. And he looks, acha, and he downs the whole business. And the scientist in me says, well, this is going to be interesting. And all day I hung around, and every now and then he'd twinkle at me. And of course, nothing happened at all. So that was the answer to that question. He continued to manifest these, what we in the West call miracles. Certainly the capacity to know everything I was thinking at all times. And lest ye see wonders and miracles, ye will not believe. And that certainly was helping. But it was only a more trivial part of the whole undertaking, it turned out. I never left the temple. I just stayed there. They took me over. They didn't ask me if I wanted to stay. There were no contracts, no promises, no anything. They just bought my clothes and put me in a room. And I met this man who then became my teacher, who was a disciple of the gurus. No place to hide. My teacher had gone into the jungle when he was 8 years old. 15 years ago, he had met the guru in the jungle. They were both called jungle sadhus. That is, they lived in caves way back in the forest. They didn't have any commerce with people. And he was a very pure Brahmin, the teacher. He weighs about 90 pounds. He's very tiny. He's a very unusual fellow. He's got his jeta piled high. His hair goes all the way down to his ankles, but it's all kept piled on his head. He moves incredibly fast. He's always rushing around. He has architecturally designed. See, what happens is this guru, who is just this little old man in a blanket, he just hangs out, see? And he sort of just hangs out. He doesn't do anything except just talk to people and people feed him. And he just does his thing in a very subtle way. And the devotees like having him around so much because he's so high that they sort of guard him. Because if they let him go, he'd sort of walk off and maybe nobody would see him again. And they have a car for him, and he just keeps disappearing here and there with a car and goes different places. And everywhere he goes, people rush up to touch his feet and be around him. So. And then all these people bring him money and gifts and stuff, and he doesn't have any use for that. He's got no game going. So then these people who bring him the gifts, they set up foundations to take care of the gifts. And then they say to him, Maharaji, what should we do? And he comes and he points to a place and he says, build a temple. Because a great saint had lived in that cave, we'll build a temple in the cave. And this teacher designs all of them. He architecturally designs them, supervised the building, ran the temples and the schools and the whole business. He taught me, he reads and writes, he's silent, he's been silent for 15 years. He reads and writes 6 or 8 languages. He has many followers of his own. His food intake for 15 years, and I lived with him and I saw what he was taking, his food intake for 15 years was 2 glasses of milk a day. That's it. That's it. He is a scrupulously honest, perfect guy. He is not, you wouldn't consider him a realized being. He's caught in what's called the golden chain, the sattvic chain, the chain of being pure. He's being good. Okay. And he taught me. He taught me everything, and he taught me so subtly. He taught me so subtly that I never knew I was being taught anything. He would walk in and into my room where I was alone most of the time. I ate alone, I lived alone, and I was left very much with my thoughts, right on the edge of freaking out all the time. And he'd walk in and he'd write on a slate, "If you wear shoe leather, the whole earth is covered with leather." And then he'd walk out. Then if you hadn't gotten that message, he felt you hadn't gotten that message, he'd send you another one. He'd say, "If a pickpocket meets a saint," he'd write, "he sees only his pockets." Then he'd leave for the day. And it was only later that I realized that he had taught me a very, very exquisitely articulated system that is several thousand years old at least, which is called Patanjali's system of Ashtanga Yoga, or eight-limbed yoga. It's also sometimes known as Raja Yoga. Because I never thought he was teaching me anything. I thought we were just hanging out and he was saying these like groovy things on his chalkboard. And he never gave me the feeling that he was saying anything to me that was new. It was all, sure, of course, you know, right, that's the way it is. The yoga consists of 8 limbs. The first 2 limbs are purification. The third limb concerns the body, asanas, which you sometimes know of as hatha yoga. The fourth limb concerns pranayama, or control of prana, or life force, or energy, through breath control. And the fifth through the eighth concern methods of controlling the mind. And all I can say to you is, as a reasonably competent social scientist, I have never yet seen such an exquisitely articulated system as that. And furthermore, I would say to you that it works. The schedule, the life I led in the temple, very simply, was I'd get up around 4:30 in the morning. I would go to the river to take my bath with a lota pouring water over me, barefoot through the snow, rush back to the huddle by my coal brazier, do breath pranayama, do asanas, do meditation, take tea in the morning, meditate in the morning and read holy books. He would come and teach me around 11, then I would do more asanas, breathing, then I would take my meal for the day alone, then I would rest and have fantasies of being somewhere else, like on the Riviera lying in the sun with a beautiful girl feeding me grapes. And then I would study some more or read or write, and then people would come and would sing holy songs, and then I would do breathing again and then asanas again and then meditation, and I'd take some warm milk and I'd go to bed. And every now and then I'd be invited to go see Maharaji, the guru. And my life was had that sameness about it, very simple, very austere, very delightful, very content. Now, I'm going to explain to you exactly what it is I now think I'm going to talk to you from within this system. I'm going to explain to you how it all is. And I'm going to remind you that there is a place in you that already knows everything I'm going to say, as you'll understand in a minute. What the teacher wrote on the slate, the first thing he wrote was, desire is a trap, desirelessness is moksha, or liberation. Desire is the creator, desire is the destroyer, desire is the universe. Desire is a trap, desirelessness is moksha, or liberation. Desire is the creator, desire is the destroyer, desire is the universe. Do you recall Buddha's Four Noble Truths? Buddha went and sat under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya for 7 days, and he saw how it all was, and then he came back to teach. And he said, who will I teach? And he thought, well, gee, I'll lay it on the guys I used to hang out with when I was doing austerities. And they were at Sarnath at the Deer Park, and he went there, and they were all bugged with him because he was no longer doing austerities, because he wasn't being pure like they were. And so when he came along, they said, let's ignore him, because he's not on the trip anymore. But he came up, and he was all shiny, and light was coming out of him. And so they found themselves, in spite of themselves, honoring him. And he sat down and he said, they said, we're not going to listen to you, though, because you don't do the thing anymore. He says, well, I'm enlightened now. And they said, yeah, but you don't do the thing. He said, but I never before told you I was enlightened, and now I'm telling you I'm enlightened. And I'm going to tell you how it is.